Carver room. Metal shelves reached from the floor to the ceiling, and on many of them were plastic tubs half-filled with water. Each was like a pond filled with hundreds of larvae. They swam about like hairy miniature snakes. We stopped to look closely at one tub of larvae. There was a tag taped to the rim, with the number 29 written in thick marker ink. The larvae twirled and twitched. Each one had a pair of pinprick-sized eyes. All the eyes were red. "So these are the famous gene-drive ones here," James said. The number 29 referred to the 29 generations of mosquitoes James had reared since beginning his experiment with Gans and Beer. After Gans created a new piece of DNA with all the gene-drive pieces, James and his team injected them into the soft eggs of mosquitoes. To his delight, the larvae hatched with red eyes, meaning that they carried two copies of the malaria-resistant gene. James and his colleagues mated the male larvae with ordinary females, and the following generation was red-eyed as well. I was now looking at generation 29, at the end of an unbroken chain of heredity. In November 2015, James and his colleagues announced that they had successfully used gene drive in mosquitoes, just 7 months after Gans and Beer had published the original mutagenic chain reaction paper. "People said that went fast," James told me as I looked at his red-eyed mosquitoes. Well, it didn't really go fast, because we'd been laboring for years. James had all the tools he needed for the experiment by the time Beer called him. "It was just another piece of DNA for us to inject," he said. The mutagenic chain reaction hit the news amidst jolting stories about experiments with CRISPR on human embryos. Human genetic engineering had been the stuff of speculation for more than 50 years, since Rollin Hotchkiss had worried over it. But the idea of overriding heredity to cure diseases with gene drive came as a bigger surprise. Even most scientists who worked on CRISPR hadn't seen it coming. There were exceptions. George Church and one of his colleagues at Harvard, Kevin Esvelt, had been musing about the idea. In 2014, they and some of their colleagues published a couple of speculative pieces, but they called CRISPR-based gene drive only a theoretical technology. Once Beer and Gans revealed the mutagenic chain reaction, the technology was no longer theoretical. Esvelt and his colleagues reported that they could use CRISPR in yeast to override Mendel's law as well. The technology might conceivably work in just about any sexually reproducing species scientists might want to alter. As Jennifer Doudna and her colleagues grappled with CRISPR's use on people, Beer, Gans, Esvelt, and other scientists began working through the implications of gene drives. At conferences and in scientific reviews, they laid out some of the ways the technology could make life better. Making mosquitoes malaria-proof could save thousands or even hundreds of thousands of lives every year. Esvelt traveled to Nantucket to propose to its residents that he use CRISPR on the island's mice. It might be possible to render them resistant to Lyme disease, breaking the disease's cycle. Plant scientists speculated about fighting the evolution of herbicide-resistant weeds. They could use gene drive to eradicate the genes that made them resistant, replacing them with genes that make the plants vulnerable once more. It might even be possible to use CRISPR to drive a population, or even an entire species, extinct. Scientists could give genes to an undesired animal that made it less fertile. The animals inheriting these genes would have fewer offspring, but thanks to CRISPR, they would end up in a growing fraction of the population. Eventually, the population would cross a tipping point and collapse. Conservation biologists had long dreamed of this kind of power to fight invasive species. When snakes and rats are introduced to remote islands, for example, they can wipe out local bird species by eating their eggs. A team of Australian scientists calculated that the introduction of 100 CRISPR-altered rodents to an island could wipe out a population of 50,000. It would take only 5 years. But gene drive might also wreak havoc. If scientists unleashed a gene drive in the wild, it might not work as they had planned. If it caused harm, it might be impossible to undo the damage. A committee organized by the National Academy of Sciences issued a report in 2016 in which it warned that gene drives had the potential to cause irreversible effects on organisms and ecosystems. Artificial gene drives represent a profound ethical quandary, arguably a bigger one than using CRISPR to genetically engineer human embryos. They may be able to alter heredity not just in the genetic sense of the word, but in other senses as well. we might drastically alter the genes that animals or plants inherit far into the future. We would also leave an ecological inheritance to our descendants that they might curse us for. To judge the wisdom of this tool, we would do well to look back at how the tools we've already invented have altered our ecological inheritance over the past 10,000 years. Human cumulative culture allowed hunter-gatherers to learn over generations how to harvest plants and control animals. Mostly without knowing it, some of them engineered new environments where agriculture could arise. Their descendants became farmers, sowing crops and raising livestock. Each new generation inherited more than just the knowledge required to farm. Humans now left an ecological inheritance to their descendants. Before about 10,000 years ago, children were born into a world sculpted by fire, hunting, and foraging. Farmers began reworking the land on a greater scale and at an accelerating pace. By clearing fields to plant, they could grow enough food to feed their families, with surplus they could sell to others. Farmers stopped moving, settling into villages with sturdy houses and granaries where they could store their extra food. A farmer could now pass down this accumulated wealth to his children, along with the land that he used to generate it. But this new form of inheritance created an inescapable tension. A family's land could be divided among the children in small portions or passed on to just one of them, leaving the rest to find other kinds of work. That tension drove some members of the family to find more land to clear. It also drove them to discover and adopt new cultural practices that let them get bigger harvests out of a given parcel, such as plows drawn by horses or oxen. By the Bronze Age, kilns were invented. Their fires reached temperatures humans had never managed before. Miners could smelt ores and smiths could work metals. They discovered that coal was a better fuel than wood. Out of these intense fires came new metal tools, including axes that farmers could use to clear more forests and plows to plant more crops. Yet these advances did not free farmers from the feedback loop between their culture and the environment. The short-term benefits they got from new farming equipment came at the long-term expense of the land's fertility. As fields eroded and became less productive, people cleared forests to work soils that would have previously been considered too poor to bother with. This feedback continued to raise the world's population, fostering more cultural innovations. And those innovations allowed people to convert even more wild lands to farms and cities. The Industrial Revolution, which came about 10,000 years after the Agricultural Revolution, was an acceleration of this feedback. Instead of using animal-drawn plows, farmers could run tractors powered with new fuels like gasoline. Instead of spreading manure from their own livestock, they could spread fertilizers extracted from mines or produced from petroleum. The cotton gathered by New World slaves no longer had to be woven by people. It was now turned over to coal-powered looms. As railroads cut across continents, cattle could be grazed on lands thousands of miles from the people who would ultimately eat them. The influence of human culture now produced a worldwide ecological inheritance. By some measures, this cultural feedback loop has been a great success. Before the Agricultural Revolution, a square kilometer of land could typically feed fewer than 10 hunter-gatherers. Today, if it's intensively farmed, it can feed thousands. In the early 1800s, more than 90% of the world lived in extreme poverty, scraping by on the equivalent of about $2 a day. Today, less than 10% are. A child born in the United States in 1900 had an average life expectancy just short of 50 years. Children born in 2016 will live, on average, to age 79. I feel fortunate that my children get to inherit this world created by cumulative culture. But I can also see that they inherit an environment that is suffering in many respects. Since the dawn of agriculture, three-quarters of the terrestrial biosphere has been converted from wilderness. Somewhere between a quarter and a third of the planet's biological productivity, its ability to convert sunlight into biomass, is now appropriated for human use. If the same cultural practices that have reworked the planet so dramatically over the past 10,000 years are inherited by future generations, we may push many species to extinction and threaten our own well-being. Our cumulative culture has even altered the atmosphere. We're not the first organisms to change the chemistry of the air. Photosynthetic bacteria began pumping oxygen into the sky 2 billion years ago, and every generation of living things has had to adapt to an oxygen-rich planet ever since. but it's unheard of for just one species of animal, using tools of its own making, to manage such a feat. When hunter-gatherers set fire to meadows or forests, they could loft carbon dioxide and other molecules into the air. Because their numbers were so low, early humans barely nudged the atmosphere's makeup. But once farmers started clearing land for planting, the soils released carbon dioxide at a greater rate. By 3,000 years ago, mining operations were belching particles of lead and other pollutants into the air. The traces of this pollution are trapped in Bronze Age layers of ice in Greenland. The same forces that led to the destruction of most wild land on Earth also polluted the air. By the Industrial Revolution, the pollution had become so thick in cities that it cut millions of lives short. As people began burning coal, oil, and gas, they also flooded the atmosphere with so much carbon dioxide that it began trapping extra heat, enough to raise the average temperature of the entire planet. By the early 21st century, humans had raised the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to its highest level in millions of years. In response, the planet had warmed about 2 degrees Fahrenheit since 1880. Much of the pollution that humans put into the atmosphere washes out swiftly. The lead-laced fumes from gasoline, for instance, disappeared soon after it was barred. Carbon dioxide is different. It hangs in the atmosphere for centuries, still trapping heat and warming the planet. If tomorrow we cut our emissions of carbon dioxide to zero, the planet would keep warming another degree or more. Future generations would inherit a planet with endangered coastlines, increased wildfires, and farmland threatened with drought. 3 million years ago, the bipedal apes who were teaching each other how to break apart rocks were a small part of a vast ecosystem. But the open-ended power of cultural heredity, transferring knowledge across generations, gave humans the power to rework the land into its own ecological inheritance, which has now led to a climatic inheritance. Today we sense that we are close to being able to alter human heredity, David Baltimore declared at the International Gene Editing Meeting in 2015. He was speaking shorthand, one that an audience at a meeting about CRISPR intuitively understood. To them, human heredity was the transmission of genes from human parents to human children. And to them, the looming ability to alter it was a new chapter in human history to be entered with awe and fear. We certainly need to come to a collective decision about using CRISPR on human embryos, to use it only in ways that help people without creating serious dangers of their own. But this shorthand about heredity poses dangers too. We risk coming to see ourselves as merely the product of the genes we inherited from our parents, and the future is nothing more than carrying those genes forward. The prospect of altering genetic heredity becomes wildly thrilling or terrifying. Soon no one will suffer from a genetic disease again, we're promised. Soon China will breed an army of super geniuses, we're assured. This shorthand makes it hard to think clearly about genetic heredity. It leads us to overvalue our ambiguous knowledge of how genes work and dismiss the other factors that shape our lives and could be reshaped to improve the world. None of this is to say we should dismiss the power of heredity or shy away from altering it. Instead, we can switch from a shorthand to a longhand. Thinking about heredity more broadly could lead plant scientists to better crops, for example. The first plant breeders manipulated the genetic makeup of crops, picking out good plants to cross to make better varieties. In recent decades, plant breeders have become more aware of the genes that their crops inherit. The epigenetic side of plant biology has only started to emerge, and some plant breeders are starting to investigate how they can tinker with it to improve crops even more. Plants sometimes naturally change their epigenetic profile. The methylation that decorates its DNA may get altered, a methyl group falling away from a gene, for example. That change may awaken the gene and improve a plant's growth. Scientists are searching for such changes and trying to propagate the plants so that the new generations inherit the same epigenetic profile. Transgenerational epigenetic inheritance is a real phenomenon in plants, but many scientists are skeptical that it matters very much in nature. It's wrong to call it Lamarckian, because Lamarck had a very different vision for the inheritance of acquired characters. He thought that inheritance could produce intricate adaptations. Skeptics like Robert Martinson see little evidence for such adaptations in wild plants. Yet that doesn't mean such adaptations are impossible. In fact, Martinson told me, He thinks we know enough now about epigenetics to try to build one. Martinson can imagine a plant that could respond to disease outbreaks by turning on immune defenses and then pass down RNA molecules to their offspring to keep those defenses turned on. If, over the generations, the disease faded away, the plants could shut the resistance genes down so that they didn't have to use their energy to make proteins they no longer needed. We could easily engineer a plant to be epigenetically adaptive, to be Lamarckian, Martinson said. Thinking broadly about heredity might help us outside of laboratories as well. In the United States, it has proven all too tempting over the centuries to blame poverty and inequality on biology. A woman like Emma Wolverton could be institutionalized for life because she was judged a genetically doomed moron. The relative poverty of African Americans could be written off, even by some psychologists, as the result of their inheriting the wrong genes. Others have argued that the gulfs in the United States are the product of the environment into which people are born and grow up. But the word environment is too bland to help us understand much about this problem. The stubborn inequalities in the United States are not the result of some people living in a physical environment. Their environment is built by social forces, and those forces last for centuries because they are regenerated across the generations. After blacks were emancipated from slavery, they still had to contend with structural racism as well as the racist attitudes of individuals. This racism did not keep springing out of the void year after year. Children learned it, either implicitly or outright, from parents and other adults, and then passed it on to their own children. The social environment then shaped the physical environment into which later generations of blacks were born. Housing discrimination and segregation created neighborhoods where children ended up in poorly performing schools, had to contend with far greater odds of getting shot, and had fewer opportunities for work. Cumulative culture allowed our species to make giant leaps in technological progress, but it also made us prone to inequality. Hunter-gatherers tend to keep these differences in check, although in a society like the Nootka of Vancouver Island, some people ended up impoverished slaves serving wealthy masters. Once farmers began building up surpluses of food, the gulf could begin to open. They could grow not just over the course of one farmer's lifetime, but across generations, because now there were goods to inherit. At first, children might inherit farms and stores of grain from their parents. Later, gold and houses and other goods enriched them. The Industrial Revolution made the entire world richer, but some people became vastly richer than others. Francis Galton's ancestors built an empire on guns and banking, which left him able to hire all the math tutors he cared to. In 1931, the historian James Truslow Adams contrasted the United States with countries like Great Britain by what he called the American Dream. He defined the dream as being that life should be made richer and fuller for everyone and opportunity remain open to all. For much of the 1900s, the United States lived up to that dream fairly well. Immigrants fared better there than they had in their home countries. As the United States grew wealthier, much of that wealth flowed to the poorest half of American citizens and allowed them to climb the economic ladder. Raj Chetty, a Stanford economist, has estimated that Americans born in 1940 had a 90% chance of making more money than their parents at age 30. But Chetty and his colleagues have found that those odds then steadily dropped. Americans born in 1984 had only a 50% chance of making more than their parents. The shift was not the result of the United States suddenly running out of money. It's just that wealthy Americans have been taking much of the extra money the economy has generated in recent decades. Chetty's research suggests that if the recent economic growth in the United States was distributed more broadly, most of the fading he has found would disappear. The rise in inequality and the decline in absolute mobility are closely linked, he and his colleagues reported in 2017. Inheritance has helped push open that gulf. About two-thirds of parental income differences among Americans persist into the next generation. Economists have found that American children who are born to parents in the 19th percentile of earners will grow up to make three times more than children of the 10th percentile. This inheritance is not simply what parents leave in their wills, but the things that they can buy for their children as they grow up. In the United States, affluent parents can afford a house in a good public school district, or even private school tuition. They can pay for college test prep classes to increase the odds their children will get into good colleges. And if they do get in, their parents can cover more of their college tuitions. Poor parents have fewer means to prepare their children to get into college. Even if their children do get accepted, they have fewer funds, and they're more vulnerable to layoffs or medical bankruptcy. Their children may graduate saddled with steep college debts or drop out before getting a degree. The gifts that children inherit can keep coming well into adulthood. Parents may help cover the cost of law school or write a check to help out with the septic tank that failed just after their children bought their first house. Protected from catastrophes that can wipe out bank accounts, young adults from affluent families can get started sooner on building their own wealth. Inheritance also goes a long way to explain the gap in wealth between races in the United States. In 2013, the median white American household had 13 times the wealth of the median black household and 10 times that of the median Latino household. In 2017, a team of researchers from Brandeis University and the public policy group Demos sifted through a number of hypotheses that might account for the differences. Going to college didn't close the gap. In fact, the researchers found, the median wealth of white people who didn't finish high school was greater than that of blacks who went to college. Black families actually save money at a greater rate than their white counterparts. Nevertheless, the median white single parent has 2.2 times more wealth than the median black household, where there are two parents. The one big difference the researchers did find was inheritance. Whites are 5 times as likely to receive major gifts from relatives, and when they do, their value is much greater. These gifts can, among other things, allow white college students to graduate with much less debt than blacks or Latinos. And the effects of these inheritances have compounded through the generations as blacks and Latinos were left outside the wealth feedback loop that benefited white families. Left unmanaged, these cultural inheritances will roll on, and future generations will be born into systems of economic inequality. The same is true for the environmental inheritance we leave. One of the most important things each new generation learns from the previous one is how to get enough energy to survive. That usually means liberating the Earth's supply of organic carbon and putting some of it in the air. Some people learn how to cut down forests to make charcoal. Others pilot cargo ships across the ocean, leaving a diesel plume trailing behind. If we carry on this way, we may manage to burn through the remaining 12 billion tons of fossil fuels tucked away inside our planet by 2250. In the process, we would be raising the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to levels not seen in the last 200 million years, raising the temperature of the planet to levels far beyond what we humans, a species of ape that evolved in the modest swings of ice ages, could handle. And the day that the final gas tank ran dry, the last light bulb winked out, the planet would not immediately set itself back to the way it was before cultural heredity became such a titanic force. It would take thousands of years for the planet to naturally draw down the carbon dioxide to levels close to what they were before the agricultural revolution. To solve a problem like global warming, we cannot come up with a clever technological fix. We are not being threatened by a giant volcano belching out carbon dioxide from the depths of the Earth, which we can simply cover with a titanic plug. Global warming is a problem of cultural inheritance. To fix it, we need a social form of CRISPR, a means to alter the practices and the values that make their way from one generation to the next. A cynic may say that there are no systems that can possibly put the brakes on the problems we have made for ourselves. But the environmental scientist Earl Ellis has observed that history records many examples of cultures that transmitted customs through the generations that allowed them to thrive while not destroying their environment in the process. The Maasai of East Africa, for example, have herded cattle for centuries on a landscape that also supported elephants, zebra, lions, and many other wild animals. The long-term health of their ecosystem was the direct result of the culture that the Maasai inherited from their ancestors. Much of their cultural identity is wrapped up in herding cattle, which means they have no need to hunt wild game. To lose a herd of cows and have to hunt marks a huge fall in status. The result was that East Africa could support the great diversity of large mammals on Earth. This is a gift to every one of us on Earth now and in the future, Ellis wrote in a 2017 essay. The megafauna and landscapes they helped to sustain might yet outlast the Great Pyramids or New York City. When the rest of us look at a culture like the Maasai, we should ask what sort of world we want to leave as a legacy, and then figure out how to do so. It may be that CRISPR can be one tool that we can use toward that end, but we must be confident it reworks the world as we truly need it to. By the time I paid a visit to Anthony James's Insectarium in 2017, Gene Drive was already becoming something of a Manhattan project. James and other researchers were getting massive grants from the United States Department of Defense, as well as from major foundations around the world. Yet neither James nor any other Gene Drive researcher had yet released a CRISPR-bearing creature into the wild, and they were in no rush to do so. They were all too aware of past attempts to fix environmental problems that had turned to ecological disasters. And since those introduced species could keep reproducing, every new generation inherited a warped ecosystem. Starting in the late 1800s, for example, Australian farmers established sugarcane farms, but they fell into a constant fight with cane beetles. In the early 1930s, an Australian entomologist named Reginald Montgomery got an idea for how to win the battle. He heard stories of the giant marine toad. Native to South and Central America, it had a tremendous appetite for insects, and some people had brought the toads to Hawaii to control sugarcane pests there. He got hold of the toads and raised 2,400 of them, and then, in 1935, he set them loose. Montgomery didn't understand that the toads were Catholic in their tastes. Soon the enormous amphibians, known in Australia as cane toads, were hopping out of the plantations and feeding on small mammals. Australian snakes and other predators sometimes tried to eat the cane toads, but a poisonous secretion in their skin made that impossible. At best, the predators spat out the toads and never tried eating them again. At worst, they died. The cane toad spread relentlessly across Australia, pushing a number of native species toward extinction. Australian researchers have tried all sorts of ways to stop them, poisoning the frogs, training native species not to try to eat them, but so far, nothing has worked. No one wants to be the Reginald Montgomery of the CRISPR age. It's possible that gene drives could go wrong by hopping from a species we want to eradicate to a related one we want to save. It's possible that changing how mosquitoes and other animals respond to one disease could lead them to carry others. Perhaps getting rid of mosquitoes might disrupt ecosystems in ways we can't yet imagine. Jennifer Kuzma and Lindsay Rawls, two legal scholars at North Carolina State University, have started to examine the ethics of gene drive as a kind of inheritance. Altering the heredity of disease-carrying insects in the short term could be tremendously valuable in the number of lives it saves and in the suffering it eliminates. But we also owe future generations a careful, forward-looking consideration of the world they will inherit. Kuzma and Rawls suggest that, by this standard, some gene drives will prove to be justified and others not. They suggest that saving endangered birds should get ranked over altering weeds. The birds deserve a higher priority because they may very well go extinct if we do nothing. Their disappearance will itself be a permanent legacy we leave to future generations. When I visited James and his colleagues, I asked them about these ethical issues. They didn't have a lot to say. It's not that they didn't care. They just had more pressing problems at hand. They weren't sure if CRISPR gene drives would work at all. After all, the natural world was littered with the remains of dead gene drives. They had evolved, raced through populations, and then stopped. In some cases, mutations destroyed them. In other cases, animals evolved defenses that kept them in check. Some biologists have argued that it would be easy for mosquitoes to evolve resistance to a CRISPR gene drive. Some of the insects might gain mutations that changed the sequence of DNA that the CRISPR guide molecules searched for. Their descendants would inherit those mutations and might outbreed the ones carrying the gene drive. It's probably easier to break because it isn't an evolved system, Beer told me. The system we're making is all completely synthetic. It's frail. Meanwhile, James was toiling away in his insectarium, trying to figure out how to make CRISPR work better. When he put Gans's malaria-fighting gene drive into a mosquito, all of its offspring inherited it. In the second generation, though, it faltered. Almost all the males inherited it, but only some of the females did. James could still carry forward the gene drive to a new generation by mating the male mosquitoes with normal females. The hairy larvae that I inspected in James's insectarium were all males from his 29th generation, ready to produce the 30th. But James still puzzled over why the female mosquitoes were proving a weak link in the hereditary chain. The answer may have to do with how mosquitoes develop from a single egg. As a female mosquito develops, it requires many divisions before some of its cells develop into a new batch of eggs. Along the way, a chromosome inside a cell may break. Cells repair this sort of damage by copying DNA from the undamaged copy of the chromosome. James suspected that, during these bouts of repair, the female mosquitoes were editing out their own CRISPR genes. Male mosquitoes, on the other hand, may not lose their gene drives because they set aside sperm cells earlier in their development. If James and his colleagues were right in this hunch, it was hard to see how to overcome it. The inner heredity of mosquitoes isn't easily altered. After James had shown me all his mosquitoes and answered all my questions, it was time for us to leave the insectarium. We stepped back out into the vestibule, and he closed the inner door loudly behind us. On the other side were thousands of mosquitoes drinking blood, and thousands of larvae writhing in tubs. Here, in the quiet of the vestibule, it was just us two humans, as far as I could tell. James turned to the pale door to the insectarium and stared at its blankness. The blue smock still hung from his arms. "The protocol is for us to stand here for a little while," he said. "See if anybody followed us out." The mosquitoes that James raises come from India. They're adapted to the wet tropical climate there. If a CRISPR-infused mosquito managed to escape James's insectarium, buzz down the hallways, slip up an elevator shaft, and dart through the doorways into the dry hills around Irvine, it would almost certainly die. And yet, even with such safeguards in place, James still stared at the door, to be sure all his mosquitoes were still penned in his insectarium. As time passed, we both grew quiet. On the other side, a potential new chapter of heredity was crawling, swimming, flying. Once James felt satisfied that no mosquitoes had escaped, he turned away from the pale inner door. He opened the outer door and we stepped out into the basement hallway. We cast off our smocks into a bin and took the elevator up to the mosquito-killing California sun. We left the next chapter penned in its underground cell, at least for now.
This is Joe Ackman. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity by Carl Zimmer. This program was directed by Bruce Mann. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text, copyright 2018 by Carl Zimmer. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.